The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, of which I suppose we are all members, has had 9 presidents since it was organized in April 1830. These presidents are Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, John Taylor, Wilford Woodruff, Lorenzo Snow, Joseph F. Smith, Heber J. Grant, George Albert Smith, and our present president, David O. McKay. The first president, Joseph Smith, was the youngest of all the presidents. He was 24 years of age when he organized the church. He presided for 14 years and was killed in Carthage jail when he was 38. It's a strange thing, but the youngest of the presidents, in my estimation, was the greatest. There is no one else who compares with him. He had the visions. He gave us the Book of Mormon. He organized the church. He gave us under God the revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants. He gave us the pearl of great price. He established the missionary work and set the church up as it is today, except for a few auxiliaries that have been added. All that we have and are as a Mormon people, we receive from that young man. What his mind encompassed, our minds cannot grasp. His intelligence seemed to be universal. His accomplishments were tremendous. When you think that that boy started in facing the world with a strange, fantastic story, and that he had to face ignorance, stupidity, persecution all his life, and that he fought the battle for a long time almost single-handed against the whole world, you can see what his battle was. It's easy enough to follow a beaten path, but it's hard to break a trail through the morass and the wilderness that was before him. I say all honor to the prophet Joseph Smith. He was our greatest man. I admire his humility, his prayerfulness. And coupled with that humility and prayerfulness, and he sought his God on every issue of his life, was a steel-like determination that could not be changed. You get humility and you get determination and couple them together in an individual and you've got something. Once George A. Smith, the prophet's cousin, was ill. He'd been ill for 6 months. Prophet called on him and George A. said, "Joseph, I'm discouraged." Joseph Smith said, "George, if you were in the bottom of the deepest coal mine and had the Rocky Mountains piled on top of you, you should not get discouraged." Prophet Joseph never knew discouragement. He never knew defeat. They could tar and feather him. They could put him in prison. The only thing that ever stopped him were the bullets of the assassins in Carthage jail. I wish I had an hour to talk to you about him. When Joseph Smith was killed, the president of the 12 was Brigham Young, 43 years of age. Totally different kind of man. I cannot find that Brigham Young ever claimed to have had what you term a vision. Brigham Young was practical. Brigham Young was the greatest believer that Joseph Smith had, in my estimation. He believed the whole story that the prophet told him from start to finish. And more than any other of Joseph Smith's followers, I think Brigham Young comprehended what Joseph Smith was trying to accomplish. He seemed to understand the whole program better than anyone else. And then he was loyal to the prophet to death. Of course, the prophet elevated him, and after a while he became president of the 12. He was in Boston when he heard of Joseph Smith's death. He read it in the newspaper 3 weeks after it happened. That's the way news traveled in those days. He made his way to Nauvoo. There were many that thought in Nauvoo that the Mormon church was finished with Joseph Smith's death. My own grandmother was there, and she said the people on her street talked it over and said we might as well go back to New England. Brigham Young stood up in a wagon, and I have talked with people that were there, and he electrified the people with his statements. He rallied them around him and the 12 apostles. He said, "Brother Joseph has laid the foundation of a kingdom, and we can build upon it. We can build a kingdom such as there never was in this world." That shows the grasp of his mind on Joseph Smith's accomplishments and his work. He was the greatest man that Joseph Smith had, and fortunately, he succeeded him. The manner in which Brigham Young brought the people to Utah is part of American history. He has become one of the 5 or 6 greatest Americans. I won't go into any of that. In his day, he brought perhaps 100,000 poor people from England and the United States across the plains, and he established them here permanently as an independent people for all time. The historians tell us that he founded upwards of 300 towns and cities. He built railroads. He built irrigation projects. He built the Salt Lake Tabernacle. And the temple is one of his projects. And this great university was first a thought in Brigham Young's mind. Brigham Young is our second greatest man. Great in his judgment. Great in his vision of the kingdom, a godlike, God-fearing man, a giant in his accomplishments. All honor to his name. He was loyal to Joseph Smith unto death. When Brigham Young died in the Lion House on the 29th of August, 1877, at the age of 76, the president of the 12 was John Taylor. Totally different kind of man again. Brigham Young had accumulated a fortune. John Taylor was a poor man. He was superintendent of public instruction in Utah. He had never gone out and sought to make money. Brigham Young was rich. John Taylor had had a different struggle. But John Taylor had something that Brigham Young didn't have. And he took hold of the church when everybody thought it would fail because Brigham Young had died. My own father heard Governor Leland Stanford say at the death of Brigham Young, he said, "Well, now the Mormon church will go to pieces. They cannot survive the death of Brigham Young." That was the second time that had been predicted. Father was just a boy, 20 years old, but he had a testimony, and he said he thought, "You wait and you'll see." John Taylor started in, and for the first time organized quarterly conferences and monthly priesthood meetings. And he redoubled his efforts in ward teaching. And he was just getting along fine in spiritualizing the church in a way that had not been done, it seemed, before through organization. When, in 1882, Congress passed a law prohibiting the practice of plural marriage in the territory of Utah, and it had been practiced up to that time. As I have looked into the history, it seems to me that the United States government was now determined to suppress polygamy. John Taylor made up his mind that he would not drop any of the doctrines that he'd been taught by the prophet Joseph Smith. But the government sent in its deputies here, and soon the penitentiary was filled with good brethren. In 1885, John Taylor went into hiding. There was a warrant for his arrest. And in 1886, Congress passed the Edmunds Tucker Law, which confiscated the property of the church. They even had to pay rent to an unfriendly receiver for the use of the tabernacle, which they had built by the labor of their hands. John Taylor was an Englishman by birth, the only Englishman, the only man outside of the continental United States who has presided over the church. Being an Englishman, he would not give up. On the 25th of July, 1887, the Deseret News front page article was that John Taylor had died in exile at the home of Thomas Roosh in Kaysville, Utah. No one knew where he was hiding. A great man, John Taylor, a confidant of Joseph Smith, a man whose mind comprehended the principles of the gospel, one of our great theologians and scholars. No one can say anything derogatory about John Taylor, one of the Lord's great leaders. They brought him to Salt Lake and buried him. The president of the 12 when John Taylor died was Wilford Woodruff, 80 years old, also hiding out down in Fairview, Utah. My father hid out, too. I know something about what I'm talking about. And I am a polygamous child. Wilford Woodruff was 80 years of age. He got the Deseret News and read that John Taylor had died. And that's the way he got the information. And he knew instantly now that the burden of leadership was upon him. And he went home and wrote a beautiful little piece in his diary. He said, "I never thought I would outlive Brother Taylor, but I have, and now I'll be called to a great appointment, and I ask God's humble blessings upon me." 80 years old, the time long since when a man could be very active. I remember this little man, Wilford Woodruff. I saw him in our tabernacle at Logan, my hometown. A little man, but a very determined man. He kept a daily diary for 67 years. And that daily diary, which we have in the church historian's office, is the foundation of a great part of our history. Whenever we want to know anything, we go and look in Brother Woodruff's diary that he kept daily for 67 years. Brother Woodruff, that little man, was one of Joseph Smith's apostles, our greatest missionary, the greatest the Mormon Church ever had. He walked more miles and preached more sermons and baptized more people than any man that's ever been in the Mormon Church from the beginning till now. At one time in England, that little man baptized 600 people in 4 months, and they were his own converts. That's the kind of missionary work that Wilford Woodruff accomplished. He made his way to Salt Lake City, was not permitted to attend the funeral of John Taylor. But after a while, through the reasoning of his mind and through the instrumentality of the Spirit, he issued, after he'd presided for a few years, he issued the manifesto in 1890, October conference, in which the Mormon people were from that time on advised to refrain from any marriage which was forbidden by the law of the land. Some people haven't found that out yet. Crossing the plains, Brother Woodruff dreamed of a temple that would be erected in Salt Lake Valley. And he saw that temple, and he said it had six towers and so on, and it was made of blue stone. He recorded that in his diary, crossing the plains with Brigham Young on the first trip. The temple was completed in 1893, and that little man climbed to the top of the temple and dedicated it to Almighty God. He lived to see great progress. In 1897, Utah celebrated the 50th anniversary of the arrival of the pioneers, and Wilford Woodruff rode in the first carriage. He presided for 11 years. In 1898, he suffered ill health. They took him to San Francisco, hoping that the sea breezes would benefit him. He died there in his sleep in September 1898 at the age of 91. The president of the 12, when Wilford Woodruff died, was Lorenzo Snow, the Mormon apostle who lived at Brigham City, 84 years and 5 months old. I don't know if those ages keep going up where we will end. I remember seeing Lorenzo Snow, a handsome man in his old years, dressed immaculately, scholarly gentleman, a refined man, dignified. He and his sister Eliza added a great deal to the Mormon Church. They were converts from Ohio in the early days. And that lovely woman, Eliza, wrote our finest poem, O My Father. Those two people, the Snows, were singular people. Refined, gentle, and yet Lorenzo Snow was an excellent businessman. Accumulated a fortune, built up a United Order arrangement in Brigham City at one time, which employed the whole town, and he operated 40 industries. A prophet, a businessman, an eloquent speaker, he became the president of the church in He was 84 years and 5 months. He presided only for 3 years. I remember him well, heard him speak on numerous occasions. I could go into detail regarding his life, but he found the Mormon Church was broke when he became the president. They had not been able to pay any tithing or collect any tithing during the anti-polygamy raids because all the funds were seized by the government and impounded. Therefore, none were sent in. He inherited nothing but debts. The Mormon Church was $1 million in debt, it is said. Lorenzo Snow, journeying up and down through these valleys, preached tithing for 3 years, and on his death, he had paid off $500,000 of the Mormon Church debt, which had accumulated during the anti-polygamy crusade that had been so terrible. Lorenzo Snow preached in the tabernacle on October 6th, 1901. He had a fever and a cold at the time. He went home, and in 4 days, he was dead. Died in the Beehive House in Salt Lake City. A good man, a great man, a scholar, a gentleman, a man who added all through his life to the strength of this church. The president of the 12 when Lorenzo Snow died was Joseph F. Smith. Joseph F. Smith was the son of Hiram Smith. His father had been killed by the assassin's bullet in Carthage jail a few seconds before the prophet was killed. I was once in Nauvoo in a party with my father and President Smith. President Smith told us about that awful night. He remembered someone knocking on the window pane of his mother's little home in Nauvoo and saying, "Sister Smith, your husband has been killed." And he remembered, he said, his mother's scream. So the little boy became fatherless at 5. That poor mother followed Brigham Young to Utah. I don't know how she ever did it. She got together a few oxen and an old wagon or two, and with her little boy helping her drive, they got to Utah. And I heard President Smith tell this story. Out in Wyoming, his widowed mother's leading ox dropped down in its tracks and rolled over with its feet up in the air, and the captain of the company came along and said, "Widow Smith, your ox is dead. Let's drag him out." She said, "I can't get to Utah without him. I can't get there without him." She says, "Where's my brother?" Her brother was Joseph Fielding. She says, "Get some oil and administer to this ox." Oh, I'll tell you, students, those things are deep. It's drowning people grasping at a straw. The brethren administered to that ox, and the old ox rolled over and got on its feet and got Widow Smith and little Joseph into Salt Lake Valley. I've heard him tell how he went to school down in Sugar House Ward, big overgrown kid. Oh, always with a quick temper. He had a little sister, Martha. The teacher called her up and chastised her for whispering and told her to hold out her hand, and he reached for a strap. Joseph F. jumped out of his desk. He says, "You hit her and I'll hit you." The teacher made a pass at little Martha with a strap. Joseph F. says, "I hauled off and laid him out cold." That was the end of President Smith's formal education. They fired him from school, and he never went again. The next year, his dear widowed mother, who had been struggling to farm 20 acres and plow and grow potatoes, think of it, died, her life beaten out in the trials of a pioneer woman, and left the boy an orphan. Brigham Young and the brethren picked him up, and they didn't know exactly what to do with him. And so he was now 15, and Brigham Young decided to send him on a mission to the Hawaiian Islands at 15. And he went. Oh, it's a pathetic story how he got down there driving a team to San Bernardino for his board, working in the wheat fields around San Francisco to get $15 to cross the ocean. And after he'd been in Honolulu for 6 months, he wrote to his Uncle George A. and he said, "Won't someone please write me a letter? I've been here 6 months and I haven't heard from a living soul." That would try the heart right out of a boy, unless he were made of gold. That boy became the greatest man I have ever personally known. Came up through distress and poverty, refined in the refiner's fire. Oh, he became an eloquent man. Wonderful in his comprehension, wonderful in his understanding, wonderful in his understanding of the principles of the gospel, the greatest preacher I have ever heard. Joseph F. Smith, the orphan boy who licked the school teacher. When he was 27, Brigham called him into his office, Brigham Young, and he said, "Joseph, the Spirit tells me to ordain you an apostle." He said, "There's no vacancy in the 12. I guess Brigham Young didn't want to get on the other side and face Hiram Smith without doing something for his boy. That's what I guess. Anyway, he put his big hands on Joseph F.'s head and ordained him an apostle. And he said, "Now don't you say anything about this, and I won't. And the first time there's a vacancy, I'll put you in." So the great man Brigham felt better that night. He had done something for Hiram's boy. Hiram couldn't do anything for him. Hiram had been killed years before. I can't take any more time on Joseph F. He's my particular hero. I've traveled with him. He was my father's best friend. Of all men I have ever seen, I admire him most. It wasn't a quality that he didn't have that made a great man. I've seen him in sorrow and distress, and I have seen him in his greatness. The most completely developed great man I have ever seen. And I'm not discounting the others. When President Smith died during the flu epidemic of the First World War, November 19th, 1918, the president of the 12 was Heber J. Grant. Another widow's son. Boys, it's no handicap to be a widow's son. It's up to you then. Someone said, to be great, it is necessary to be born poor, because the poor have to struggle. Heber J. Grant sold newspapers, shined shoes on the streets of Salt Lake, did everything he could to pull himself up, became an insurance salesman at the age of 17, and at 21 built his mother a nice home in Salt Lake City, which still stands, and became a wealthy insurance salesman. The church picked him up because principally because I think that he was a man of destiny. It had been prophesied on his head when he was a baby that he would one day be an apostle by Eliza R. Snow, the woman I spoke of, in tongues. She spoke of this child and prophesied that he would be one of the 12. Therefore, he was a man of destiny. In 1882, when Heber J. Grant was 26 years old, John Taylor sent for him and presented his name to be a member of the Quorum. I knew President Grant intimately. He was my mission president in Europe at one time. I've traveled with him. He came to Berlin where I was a poor little missionary, and I had to stand on one side of him while he talked. He started in on a lot of things that I didn't know the German words for, such as baseball. And I said, I can't translate that. I'm sorry, President Grant. He says, well, get me someone up here that knows something. That was an embarrassing moment. Heber J. Grant presided over this church 26 years, the second longest administration of any president. And during that time, the church doubled its population, more than doubled, went from 495,000 to 895,000, added 500,000 during President Grant's administration. He was successful in every way. He died on May 14th, 1945, at his home on 8th Avenue, 86 years old. President of the 12 was George Albert Smith. George Albert Smith was born in 1870 across the street from the Temple and Tabernacle on the west. His father was John Henry Smith. His grandfather was George A. Smith, that I'm writing about now in the church section. And his great-grandfather was John Smith, who was the prophet's uncle. So he came down through that Smith family. I knew George Albert intimately. I served 10 years with him on the mutual board. And I'll just say one thing. President George Albert Smith was the most Christ-like man I have ever known. When I was writing a sketch of his life, I asked him if I could see his diaries. He said, yes, if you won't tell anyone what's in there. And I said, I won't. He brought me a stack that high. It took me a year to read them. They covered 45 years. There wasn't an unkind word towards a living soul. A lot of people did him dirty tricks. And the worst he'd say was, I wish people wouldn't act like that. He brought a new scotch. Is that it? I'm always scared of the clock. He brought a new lap robe from Europe when he was over there, and it was stolen out of his car on Main Street about 10 minutes while he was in a store. And I read it in the diary, and I thought, now what's he going to say? He wrote in his diary, and he says, I wish I knew the man that stole my otter robe. I would have given it to him. Then he would not have been a thief. That's all he said. It was just impossible for him to dislike anybody, black, white, yellow, or any other color. George Albert loved every one of God's children, and you've heard him say it 1,000 times. Just try that. If you want to know how hard that is to accomplish. Oh, I could tell you a lot of things. I saw a little scrub woman come into his office while he was president of the church. He ran and got his best chair for her and had her sit right up by him. You'd have thought she was the Queen of Holland or someone else come to call on him. He loved everybody. He did not dislike anybody. He had achieved a universal love for all God's children. Well, there's 1 minute. The next president after George Albert died? David O. McKay. The elegant man, I call him an elegant man, who now presides over the church. Handsome, dignified, scholarly, firm in the faith. He's got every attribute that makes a great president of the church. I've sat for 3 days just recently and looked at him at our last conference. What a wonderful man. The very height of all that is manhood. David O. McKay, a child of promise. When he received his patriarchal blessing, a little country boy up in Huntsville, the patriarch said to him in 83, I believe, he said, "Brother David O., the eye of the Lord is upon you. You will be called into the leading councils of the church, and you will preside among the people." That was given to him when he was 13 years old. A man of destiny, a great man. I hope he lives 100 years. Well, my time is up. My candid opinion is that these 9 men are the finest men that have lived in this world in the last 120 years. I do not think that you can bring forward anyone who will match them. God bless you. Amen.